hello to my single-digit number of listeners today. This podcast is brought to you by the Ann Arbor chapter of the Please Give Me an A Foundation. I'd like to begin by talking about a name who we are all familiar with by now, George Floyd. We've heard his name on the news, seen it written in spray paint on buildings, and pasted over posters that fill our streets. Just last week, the entire country awaited the verdict of the trial of the former police officer Derek Chauvin, the officer who murdered George Floyd. This ongoing battle for the rights of black communities in the United States began hundreds of years ago. There are thousands of court cases on this topic of systematic racism, and today we're going to focus on the case of Collender v. Lawson, which was argued in the United States Supreme Court on November 8, 1982, and decided on May 2, 1983. In this case, Edward Lawson, an African-American man who was stated to have worn his hair in long dreadlocks, was detained or arrested on 15 different occasions between March 1975 and January 1977 under a statute created by the California State of Appeals. The statute required that anyone who was loitering or wandering the streets provide credible and reliable identification when asked by a peace officer, being any sort of law enforcement official like a police officer. This identification was to show that the individual had reasonable assurance that their identification was authentic. This was to provide means for the officer to later get in touch with the individual who identified himself or herself. This rather vague statute left immense discretion to peace officers, as it allowed them to decide who needed to be approached under the statute in the first place and what sort of identification was sufficient. When the case was heard in the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, the appellants provide an example of what sufficient identification may look like. They stated that if the suspect was a jogger who was not carrying identification, the jogger could tell the officer the route by which they had jogged until the point where the officer detained them. This reflects the subjectivity of the statute, which provides far too much power to law enforcement. Laws like this statute were rampant in the 80s, and they were a consequence of Lyndon B. Johnson and Nixon administration's war on crime. The intended result of the war on crime was to reduce crime rates, which would be achieved through policies and laws that targeted criminal activity. These policies increased neighborhood-based law enforcement, which actually resulted in illegal surveillance of black neighborhoods and police harassment of minorities in white neighborhoods, which is exactly what we're seeing in this case. This era of policy resulted in a variety of latent dysfunctions, including increased rates of prisoners that would burden the U.S. financial system and the perpetuation of systematic racism. However, I have to wonder if the dysfunction of strengthening systematic racism may have been intended after all. Many laws, including this one, were enacted in such a way that communities of color were disproportionately affected. This wasn't a product of their violations of the law, but rather a reflection of how law enforcement focused on enforcing the laws specifically on people of color. As a result, people of color, particularly the African American and Latinx communities, were questioned or arrested on occasions where they weren't even causing any harm or breaking any laws. The experiences of Edward Lawson thus not isolated instances. In response to his mistreatment that was justified by the statute, Edward Lawson brought a civil action case to the District Court for the Southern District of California. He sought for the statute 647E to be ruled unconstitutional. He sought an injunction to limit how the statute is enforced, and he wanted compensatory and punitive damages against the officers who detained him. The district court ruled that the statute was in fact unconstitutional, but they refused to award damages to Lawson. Both parties, being Lawson and the defendants, appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. The appeals court upheld the ruling that the statute was unconstitutional and reversed the ruling on the damages. They then sent it back to the district court for a jury trial. The appeals court's basis for the ruling of the unconstitutionality of the statute was that it violated the Fourth Amendment, which protects against unreasonable search and seizures. Additionally, according to the rule of law, a statute remains constitutional only if it is enforced fairly and if citizens are given a fair notice of the behavior required by the statute. Given the vague nature of the statute, which leaves an immense amount of discretion to law enforcement and doesn't outline what valid identification is, the statute was also ruled unconstitutional under the rule of law. So now that we've made it through all the district and appeals courts, we're finally at the Supreme Court. because the defendants, being the police officers, appealed to United States Supreme Court because they thought that the law was actually constitutional, and for some reason they thought the Supreme Court would agree. Fun fact, they didn't. The ruling of the Court of Appeals was ultimately upheld in the Supreme Court with a ruling of 7-2. It was added that this statute infringed on people's right to movement, which furthered its reasoning for being unconstitutional. Furthermore, the statute also violated the substantive due process of law clause, which protects an individual's right to life, liberty, and property from the state. In all three courts, the law was ruled unconstitutional. The focus during these trials was that the statute allowed police officers to essentially approach any individual due to the lack of detail on who was to be approached under the statute and the vagueness of what exactly credible and reliable identification looked like. These two aspects violated the rule of law, the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, and the 4th Amendment. So now that we've gone over the details of the case, let's start looking at the legacy of Collin v. Lawson. So this case was one of many cases that began to dismantle the systemic racism interwoven in policies, specifically those that were a product of the war on crime. In 1998, during the case of Chicago v. Morales, the ruling of Collin v. Lawson was actually used as the precedent. In this case, Chicago Gang Congregation Ordinance allowed police officers to approach those who they perceived to be gang members and demand they disperse if they were loitering. This ordinance was ruled to be unconstitutional due to its violation of the Due Process Clause, the 14th Amendment, along with the precedent for such laws set during Collin v. Lawson. It's important to note here that both of these cases are protecting people of color, specifically African Americans' right to movement. Laws that targeted this group unfairly or allowed police officers to target them were ruled to be unconstitutional. In this case, we are seeing that courts are actively trying to protect the freedoms of a population who have been repeatedly abused by the law. Laws like the statute in Collin v. Lawson are a symptom of a greater problem, being systematic racism in the United States. So now let's look closer at that phrase, systematic racism. The word systematic or institutionalized refers to the laws and structures in place that govern a group of people and how they act. When such laws are created, policymakers ask themselves the questions of who are the stakeholders? How are they framing the problem? Is the distribution of benefits and burdens of a policy fair? The second word, racism, can be better understood through the lens of the critical race theory. The critical race theory explains that racism exists, meaning that prejudice against others is normal, and that this is the status quo in most societies, including the United States. It also states that race is a social, not a biological construct. Notions of race vary across societies and can even shift within societies over time. Given this information, I think we can safely conclude that racism itself is an aspect of American culture. It's a purely cultural phenomenon, and we can see the significance and the role it plays in the United States during this era when we look at other current events as well. For example, in 1978, one of the key cases that supported affirmative action, Regents of the University of California v. Bake, was decided. The Black Power movement was also peaking in the 70s, where we see further pushback against racism by oppressed groups. And lastly, the Miami race riots occurred in 1980 in response to the acquittal of police officers who had beaten Black motorcyclist Arthur McDuffie. Now, given this information on the cultural environment of the time, can you imagine a lawmaker asking themselves the question of, is the distribution of benefits and burdens of this policy fair? Given all the events that are happening at the same time period as this law, I think it's virtually impossible to say that a lawmaker could not have predicted that the statute would unfairly burden people of color. The reason for this is attributed largely to American culture. Racism was, and still is, interwoven through culture and is viewed as the cultural norm. We can see how this affected political institutions and laws through systematic or institutionalized racism in cases like Collin v. Lawson, where lawmakers' views on legible personhood were directly defined by who was viewed as deserving of rights in the cultural environment of the time. We can see this concept in a variety of other laws as well, including the Three Strikes Law and the cash bail system, both of which disproportionately affect people of color. So I've explained to you how culture affects law by playing a role in the mindset of lawmakers.
but it's also important to recognize that policymakers here have power to influence culture as well, because the laws they create can justify cultural trends and strengthen them. For example, up until 1968, when the Fair Housing Act was passed, redlining was occurring in neighborhoods. Such policies essentially promoted segregation by providing a mechanism for segregation to occur. As a result, progress to dismantle racist ideas were hindered, since policies were communicating to the American public that racism can be justified. Racist practices like this were made to look neutral, which emphasizes how laws can directly shape cultural views and justifications for racism. This relationship, encompassed by systematic racism, reflects how law is defined by culture, but how culture is also defined by law. So the two concepts are completely intertwined. So today we've gone over the case of Collender versus Lawson and the role of culture in law and systematic racism, and how we can see that in the case of Collender versus Lawson. Edward Lawson was just one of hundreds of thousands of African Americans who have been unfairly burdened by laws that are targeting people of color. His case is one of the few cases where we actually see justice systems functioning as they are supposed to, as all three courts actually ruled in his favor. His case set a precedent that would pave the way for dismantling other unconstitutional and racist laws, including the Chicago Ordinance from the case Chicago versus Morales. Just last week, we saw the continuation of the legacy of this case, where Derek Chauvin was found to be guilty of unintentional second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. Laws regarding policing are a culmination of the long-standing history of racism in the cultural environment in the United States. So I leave you today with one question. If racism is a part of our culture that shapes law, what is our role in reshaping culture so that we can live in a country where law enforcement, who's supposed to make people safe, will stop harming communities of color? Thank you for joining me today. For more information on the relationship between law and culture within court cases, please check out the Anthroculture 252 podcast series.